This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 106. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 106. Today, you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, and we have listeners of all different skill levels and genres in photography. And so usually we kind of keep things mixed up with questions that kind of benefit everybody. But in this episode, we are really going to niche down and just talk to the newer beginning photographers. Anybody, if you have any questions at all about the exposure triangle still, this is the episode for you. For those of you who are not beginners, you know, you're more intermediate and advanced photographers, yeah, you know what? We're still going to be friends if you just close out this podcast and join us on the next episode. But we've received some feedback lately that sometimes we're leaving the beginners in the dust, and so we want to do a complete episode just focused on you guys. So if you're signing out now, we'll see you next week. We're still friends. And if you're a beginner, this is perfect for you. And to talk all about it is my friend Darren Miller.
Hey, Jim, I'm super excited for this approach to answer some beginner questions. So without any further ado, you ready to get started?
Let's do this.
All right. Our first question comes from Angie. I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name on that, but
Leskovskuti.
There you go. I've been an amateur photographer for quite a few years and use it as a hobby only, but cannot master the manual settings on how it works. What's the best way to remember and understand the right settings in different surroundings? I think that's just understanding the exposure triangle to the T, as Jim was teasing towards the beginning of the episode, and that is composed of aperture, shutter speed, and ISO. And I'll let Jim dive in a little bit deeper on what each of those means real quick.
Okay, so I think the very best way to learn this is to go out and do some night photography. Just do it once, and I think it's going to help so much. So let's use that as an example, like close your eyes, and be with me on the beach. So we're going to Oregon for our free photography workshops next month, and we're going to do a night photography shoot at a lighthouse. So picture you're there on, whoosh, just kidding. All right, we're on the beach. We're taking pictures together of this night scene. So we got our camera, and we're going to take a picture. Now, because it's really dark outside, we're going to have to use a long shutter speed. All shutter speed means is the camera is going to take a picture for a long time. It's going to be recording it for a length of time. And when it's really, really dark outside, we may use a shutter speed of 30 seconds. But when it's the daytime, there's no way we would use a shutter speed that long because it would record so much light that it would just be a white picture. But in this particular situation, we're going to use a 30-second exposure. You know, a typical exposure for the day is going to be 1/500th of a second, 1/2000th of a second, really short amount of time. But we're at night, so we're going to use a 30-second shutter speed. Now, if I'm holding the camera and I take a 30-second picture, look at your hands. See how they tremble just slightly? Wait, you can open your eyes to look at them now. You're looking at your hands and you can see they tremble just slightly. We can't hold things perfectly steady. And so if I were to take a picture for 30 seconds holding the camera, it's going to be a blurry mess, because you're moving the camera while it's still recording. And so that's not going to work. So we better get a tripod. We got our tripod and we locked our camera on it. Now it's perfectly still. Nothing's moving. And so we can take a picture for 30 seconds of the beach, the water, and the stars in the sky, and it's going to look pretty good. Now, as when we get that picture back that's a 30-second shutter speed, you're going to see some movement in the water because the water was moving even though everything else was still. You know, the sand's not going anywhere, but the water was moving. So there could be some blurriness there, but it might just be kind of a cool effect. So that's our shutter speed. We got one part of the exposure triangle nailed. Now, the next thing we need to worry about is the aperture. All the aperture means is how big of a hole should the lens have in it to allow light to get through. Obviously, a big hole in your lens is going to let through more light than a small hole. So if we're at night and it's really dark outside, we want the biggest hole in the lens possible that's going to let in the most amount of light. And when I say hole, there's actually a little tiny thing inside your lens. Sometimes you can see it if you look through the back of the lens, that opens up and closes down, and that makes the hole in the lens that lets the light through. This is the aperture. And so if we're taking a picture at night, we want to open it up a whole bunch so we can let a lot of light in. Now, the aperture has one thing that, now aperture controls how much light is in there, but it also controls one other thing, and that is the depth of field. You've seen pictures where you have somebody sharp in the foreground, but then the background looks blurry. And that's kind of the hallmark of a professional portrait, is that's kind of how we tell the difference between that and a cell phone photo. And so that's controlled also by the aperture. If you have a big hole in your aperture, it's going to create shallow depth of field. That means only a sliver of the picture is going to be in sharp focus, and the rest of it is going to be blurry. So that's the aperture. It controls the depth of field and how much light gets through the lens by that hole. The last thing that's in the exposure triangle is the ISO. This is technically maybe not correct, but we're going to explain it by the software on your camera. It's what's in your camera that just tells the camera, hey, be a little bit more sensitive to light. It's dark out there. Yeah. And that's what it does. But it also controls one other thing, and that is how much noise is in the picture. If you make your camera really sensitive to light, has a really high ISO, then it also gathers more noise and grain in the picture. So those are the three elements of the exposure triangle. And the question that I get every time I teach this at this point is, why is it so complicated? Why do you have to have three things to control the exposure triangle? Why can't we just have like brightness? you know, wouldn't that be nice if your camera just said brightness? How bright do you want it to be? Well, that would be great, except let's say we were out taking a picture of a beach and we knew we wanted to open up everything. But since we had a big aperture the first time, what if now we put a person in the foreground and we want to take a picture of that person on the beach and the beach in the background? Well, if we had used that wide open aperture to give a lot of depth, to gather a lot of light, then that's also going to create shallow depth of field. The beach behind the person is just going to be blurry. We won't be able to see the pier, the stars very clearly, whatever it is in the background, because that's going to be blurry. And so in this situation, we actually need a smaller aperture so that we can get more depth of field. You see, each shooting situation is different. And so you need to work these three different aspects of the exposure triangle to get it just right. It feels like you're learning a different language at the start. It feels like you're going back to middle school math and how much you had to struggle to learn that. But once you get some practice with it and you just accept, this is going to be a little bit complicated, but I'm going to keep practicing at this, eventually it's going to click and you won't even have to think about your camera settings when you go to shoot. My camera settings are the last consideration I have when I go out to shoot, because it's just automatic now. Rarely am I faced with a situation where it's like, oh boy, what aperture do I pick? That just doesn't happen anymore. It just kind of happens automatically. So be patient with yourself. This is going to take some time. Don't ignore this and stick with automatic mode, or else you're going to hamper your progress in learning photography. Just accept this is going to be a little bit complicated, but you're going to get there.
Yes, and one other thing I'd throw in there is maybe also mess around with shooting in the aperture priority mode or the shutter priority mode, just so you can learn one part of the triangle at each time. And also remember, when you're in those modes, you do have control over your ISO. So it might default to auto ISO, which Jim was mentioning controls your the software in the camera's light sensitivity and noise. So make sure you're cognizant of that, because if you get everything right, the worst thing you want to end up with is a really noisy photo because it chose an aperture of 12,000 or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Rachel Michelle Broxson asks, how can I get over the feeling of feeling discouraged? I feel terrible when I go out, take 500 photos, and only one of them turns out. Every photographer understands this. You've mm-hmm. been there, right, Darren?
Yes. I think that if I come home with more photos than a certain ratio that are actually perfect, and then some that are all blurry or whatnot, I'm actually upset with myself that I didn't challenge myself. So I think every photographer empathizes with that, because when we challenge ourselves, we see some imperfections in some shots, and then we get it and it clicks. It's kind of like what Jim was talking about, where you kind of get a feel for aperture and camera settings. It clicks within our shooting, and then the picture turns out well. If you have one keeper out of 500, hey, I call that a success.
Yeah, I think this is just something that we need to set aside, Rachel. We went to Iceland with the Improved Photography Travel Group, and I was just looking at my photos yesterday, and there are probably 20 of them that I'm happy with, and I took thousands of photos over several days. Probably about 20 photos that I'm happy with, probably only three that I'm really excited by, and only one of my photos made it into my portfolio. And so, the ratio that you're talking about is actually very normal. The problem that I think may be happening, Rachel, is you're seeing the best photos that other photographers take. And a lot of these photographers are working full-time, traveling the world to take these photos. And you're comparing your worst photos, your percentage, with only seeing the best of theirs. You know, if you could sit next to me and look through my photos of Iceland, you'd be like, yee, dull. Uninspiring, awful. That one's bad. Ooh, don't keep that. That one's blurry. Oh, that one's kind of nice. And you're going to find that the ratio is really the same. I don't really find that my ratio of keepers is really increasing. What is increasing over the years is what I consider a keeper. Kind of my portfolio as a whole is just kind of going up, and all the photos are getting a little bit better, but still that ratio is about the same. I still only want to get the very best. I only want to, get the cream of the crop of what I've shot. And that's probably never going to change. You're probably still going to always want only your very best. So that's normal. But, that's probably not going to make you feel any better. One thing that I can say that probably will be really encouraging to you is come shoot with us. Darren and I are traveling the world this year to get out and shoot with people in the Improved Photography community, and we're doing it completely free. We're paying out of our own pockets to travel around and just spend time shooting with everybody. Go to improvephotography.com/workshops and come shoot with us. Just pay your own travel expenses and you can spend a few days with us shooting. We'll help you out. Look at your portfolio. But the biggest thing that I find is helpful about trips like that, and that gets a fire under people and gets them going, is that you're shooting with another photographer who's more experienced. You're at a location and we've done a lot of work to make sure you're going to be successful there. So, let's say this Oregon trip that we're doing, I've spent tons, hours and hours of work finding good locations, and I'm going to be there shooting with you. You can snuggle up your tripod right next to mine, ask questions about the camera settings. You're going to come home with some knockout photos. And I learn tons from people in those workshops too. And I'm not just saying that to give it lip service. I mean, I really do. Every time I go out with the travel group, somebody's taking a picture or puts their tripod in a different spot, and I think, ooh, that was a good idea. And I'll go say, hey, do you mind if I try that too? And you end up with some awesome photos. So if you really want to be encouraged, go shoot with a group. Come shoot with us. It's free. Search for meetup groups in your city. Take a local photography class. Get out and shoot with somebody, and you're going to see how other people work, and you're going to start to get some really good keepers.
Yes, and I think some things will click where she'll also see that not everyone's keeping 100% of their images or even close to 100% of the images they shoot while she's shooting alongside them.
Right. All right. Rohit Mahakali says, I usually adjust my ISO and shutter by experimenting. But when it's truly bright, it's hard to see the image properly in the LCD of my Canon D5100, which makes it trickier to make corrections quickly. Any suggestions? The answer is...
boom.
Use your histogram.
Yep.
So you just press, when you press play on the back of your camera so you can see the picture, you're either going to press your info button or your up button, on the four-way selector. And that's going to give you a little graph, a little histogram of the exposure levels in the photo. And whatever's on the left, if you see a big spike of data on the left, that means it's dark. Whatever you see on the right is bright. Anything that touches the far right edge of the graph or touches the far left of the graph is clipped. That means that it's so dark or so bright if it's on the right that the camera can't record any detail there. It's just completely white or completely black. So when you're shooting during the day and you can't see the LCD screen well to judge exposure, just turn on that histogram. You can see that just fine, and you'll be able to see where the exposure levels are in the photo.
Very good tip. And Darius Roganinski says, why is the back button focusing better than the shutter one? And he would like a couple examples. And I think we've kind of gone back and forth on this, on whether or not back button focusing is always the best choice, or whether keeping your standard focusing when you depress your camera shutter button halfway down is the correct way of focusing. So just for the beginners out there, when you shoot with your camera, just think about holding your camera in hand and you're looking through your viewfinder, or you're actually through the back of your camera on the LCD screen. As soon as you press halfway down on that shutter button, it locks in focus. And that's what this user is asking about, is what's the difference between that and actually assigning a button on the back of our camera to take place of us pressing the shutter button halfway down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so an example of where you may want back button focus. Let's say you're shooting a Canon Rebel and you only have, 11 focus points on it, 11 different spots in the frame where the camera can focus. Well, let's say I'm taking a portrait and I want to put the person at the top left of the frame, to kind of follow the rule of thirds. Well, I don't have a focus point there. And so what I need to do is I want to use the center focus point and aim that center focus point right at their eye, so we get focus right on the eye where it should be. And I focus, and then I want to recompose. I want to move the frame now so that they're at the top left, but keep the focus where it was. And then I take the picture. So I just keep my shutter button halfway down as I recompose, and then the focus stays there, and then I compress the rest of the way down to take the picture. Well, that works fine. But if you want to take multiple pictures and not need to focus between each one, you could just press the back button focus one time, and then the focus won't move as you take successive pictures. So that would be a situation where back button focus could work. Or you're shooting a sports game. Or let's say you're shooting a bird flying through the trees. You focus on the bird, but then if you keep your finger halfway down on the shutter button so that you're ready to take a picture, as you pan across a tree, then your camera sees the trees and says, oh, got to focus closer, focuses on the tree, and then the bird behind it as you continue to pan, and you're focused on the tree instead of the bird. Ah! So you can just use back button focus, and it makes it a little bit easier to just let go of the focus as you go over the tree, and then you're back on the bird. Is this necessary to use? No, definitely not. Do most professional photographers use back button focus? No. But there are some professional photographers who love it and swear by it. For me personally, I go back and forth. Sometimes I'll set it up on my camera, and in a particular situation, I find, boy, that was kind of useful. Other times I find it's just one more thing to think about. Oh, my focus is on the back button now, or I've got to set it up when I get a new camera, and so I just don't even bother. So not necessary to get good sharp photos, but it can help in some situations.
Yeah, and it also leads to Christine Matron Ghost question. She says that she feels that she's focusing and recomposing and it's not working for her. Her images are not coming out as sharp, and what can she be doing wrong? And this might be a situation I would personally think where back button focusing might be applicable, to where she might be focusing using the right top corner of the photo and then holding her shutter button down and then subsequently taking more photos within that session, but the camera has already readjusted its focus because every time you let up on that shutter button, it's going to refocus.
Good point. Ashley Floyd asks, how do I take a photo and make sure everyone in the photo is crisp and clean without any blurriness in the background? I get like one or two people that are crisp, but then the rest of them are blurry. And she's using a Canon Rebel T3i. Well, the problem is the aperture. You're going to need to stop down the aperture, maybe to f11, something like that, to get everybody in nice sharp focus. The problem is that their faces are staggered. One person's a little bit in front of or behind the others, and so they get out of the plane of depth of field. So, that's kind of the way to fix this is, one, you're going to have to pose everybody so they're more on the same line so that they're all in the plane of focus, or you're going to have to stop down your aperture. The problem with stopping down the aperture is it's going to slow down your shutter speed to get the same exposure. And by doing that, sometimes you're going to get a blurry picture just from too much camera shake. So be cautious about that. Make sure you don't stop down too much that you have too slow of a shutter speed. And if you're just stuck and you can't do it, then you may need to add some light so that you can make this happen, like with a flash.
And also in her question, she indicated that she wanted to have the background blurred out. So if she wants to blur out the background, you also need to position your subjects far enough away from the background that it doesn't fall within that area of focus. That way you can get that blurred out background because it's not falling within the depth of field that can be in focus at the aperture you set your camera at.
Right. It's really the same process. If you want a group photo that has shallow depth of field so the background is blurred, then the most important thing is, since we can't stop down the aperture, you're going to have to get everybody on the exact same plane of focus so that we can focus and get all of the line of people in sharp focus and use shallow depth of field so the background's blurry.
Very good tip.
Shahzad Ali asks, what exactly does a light meter do? Well, a light meter just tells you how much light is in the scene. Every camera has a light meter built into it. So that's how aperture priority mode or shutter priority mode works, is you set the aperture in aperture priority and the camera uses a light meter. It judges how much light is in the scene and sets the shutter speed accordingly, according to the aperture you set, so that it will match the lighting conditions so you have a good exposure. So that's what a light meter does. Now, some people use a separate light meter when you're taking portraits, for example, and it's a little handheld device that you, like, let's say I'm taking a picture of a model. I set up my flashes, and then I walk over to the model using this handheld light meter, hold it under their chin, and I take a picture so the flashes go off. And then that light meter is going to tell me how much light is there and what f-stop I'm going to need to use to get a properly exposed picture with that much flash. And so some people like using them. Some people find it easier. The vast majority of photographers find this is unnecessary and just adds to one more thing that you need to do. I find it's much easier just to look at the LCD screen on the back of your camera and just see if the photo looks like it's exposed properly. If the flash is too bright, turn it down. If the flash is too dim, turn it up. And you're set to go. No math, no need for light meters, no need to do a light reading. You just take the darn picture and see what it looks like.
Yeah, and it can also benefit you in working with your clients at first to kind of get them to loosen up and say, hey, you know, do what you need to do. I'm just doing some practice shots. I think that also helps from a conversational and breaking the ice standpoint as well. All right, our next question is from Min Tran, and he wants to know why his picture is looking so yellow and out of focus. He's shooting it at f3.8, 1/60th of a second. His ISO is on 1600, and he's using the 18 to 200 millimeters set at a 22 millimeter focal length, and he's using manual for his exposure settings, and he's using a Nikon D300S, and he wants to know what's going on. I can easily tell just by the camera settings as far as why it's out of focus. We have a slower shutter speed here, 1/60th of a second, and it is 1/1 focal length, which can help reduce some camera shake in there, but it still could be enough camera shake, depending on who's shooting the photo, that it's still causing it to be blurry and out of focus. Also something to look at, since we were talking about the exposure triangle, is the fact that it was shot at f3.8. And the picture that Mr. Tran attached to this photo here is a picture of two people, and with two people in the photo, I would personally have shoot with a little bit smaller aperture just so I could ensure both people are within focus in the photo. Shooting an f3.8 would be maybe a little bit more appropriate for photographing one person, but if there's two people in the photo, like Jim said, they could be on different focal planes to where the focus is going to fall, and I think that f3.8 is really going to be killing your sharpness as well as that extremely high ISO that you're using.
Yeah, and the yellow look in the photo is just a white balance problem. Just change your white balance to be a little bit cooler. All right, Kalina Rawls-Hescu says, everybody tells me that my files are too big when I deliver them to clients. What is an appropriate file size? Your clients are kind of crazy here.
Yeah.
They don't understand that when you give them a big file, it means they're getting the full resolution and you're not throwing out detail by giving them a smaller photo. So I think you just need to tell the client that the reason the file is big is because I want you to have the full resolution thing. Now, one caveat to that is make sure you're sending them JPEGs. I definitely wouldn't send PSDs or TIFFs to a client unless it was a very high-end client. You know, if you have a TIFF of your photo, it could easily be 2-3 gigabytes. And so that may be a little bit excessive. Just export to a JPEG and then you'll be fine.
Yep. I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding Dustin's question here. Or Dustin, he said that he's shooting his new Nikon 35mm lens and showing a focal distance of 5.01 meters and landscapes focused on the distance. Should he be worried about his lens being faulty or whether or not the metadata, which is also called the EXIF data, which is the information that our cameras record when we take a photo and each and every photo, whether that is rough or whether or not it's probably ready or inaccurate. With that, it's just really hard to tell with the question what the exact problem is with your lens. So I just can't really dive into that one.
Okay. Chandra Jenki says, what's a good book for DSLR photography? All right. I'm sorry. This is a little bit self-indulgent, but I have a book on beginning photography. It's an ebook. You can find on Amazon.com. Just search for Improve Your Photography or just search my name, Jim Harmer. And it's a short book. It's like 60 pages and it just condenses the very basics, most important part of photography into 60 pages. I just wrote it to be as straightforward and easy to understand as possible. So if you like the way that I explain photography, check that out. I get a lot of really positive feedback on it is the only reason I mentioned it. So it may be a good one for you. If you don't like learning in book format and you need to kind of see things to understand how to set your camera up, then I would really recommend our classes at photoclasses.com. Our beginning photography class gets excellent, excellent reviews. I've recorded all the video training for that. So you get 26 videos. They're short, consumable videos, about 10 minutes long each. And you can just watch one each day or whenever you have time for them. They're available for you anytime. And then if you ever have questions, not sure how to do something on your camera, send us an email. And when you send us the email, guess who's the person who answers that email?
Me.
Darren Miller. You're going to get us. We're personally teaching you. You know, you can watch the videos, and if you don't have questions, you're good to go. But if you have, if you do have questions, send Darren an email. You'll get it as a student. You can contact him as much as you want during the class and get some help. So if you prefer learning that way, check that out as well. There are lots of other places to learn. And if you're strapped, you can't pay for one of these solutions that's going to help you walk through it a lot more, then at least go to improvephotography.com/basics. And we have a free 10-page tutorial there on just getting started on the most important parts of photography. That's totally free and at least give you a good place to start from.
Yes, it's a great starting point, and I find myself recommending it to a lot of people when I'm asked out and about, where do I begin? It's a great starting point.
All right, Naraj Shah says, how can I tell if my sensor has dust on it? Easiest way that I find is to go take a picture of the blue sky. Just wait for a clear day, go take a picture of it, just snap a clear spot of blue sky, and you'll know in an instant if you have dust on your sensor. It'll be really obvious. You'll have, just visible spots everywhere. And just be sure Well, this can be helpful, is to stop down your aperture a little bit, maybe to f7 or f8, something like that. You just don't want to be wide open at like f4, f2.8, something like that. But you'll see if you have dust spots immediately.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you what aperture you recommended with that.
Well, that does it for our questions today. Thank you for joining us on this beginner episode of the Improved Photography Podcast. And I hope we've pointed you to some good areas that you can continue learning. We really appreciate your support of Improved Photography and your download. And we will see you in another 7 days.